And obviously read from your program, which I'm doing. The usual format will be for the paper, 20-25 minutes, and then 5 or 10 minutes of questions. The second paper, again, with the repeated questions afterward. Frank swears he doesn't need the microphone, but they want, says, please use the microphone so we can get things recorded. So if you don't come up with your questions to the microphone, then the speakers will have to repeat the question, rephrase it, and go from there. So Nancy will be our first speaker.
Not used to using these things. Can you hear me? Is that good? Thanks for coming today. I want to start by just saying a little bit about who I am and why I did this article. I'm in the second year of the master's program in journalism and Latin American studies at Berkeley. And what I'm presenting today is some research I conducted for a magazine article, which I am now working on getting published, about Latinos in the church. One thing that's important for you to know, I'm not LDS. So I'm coming at this from a very, very much of an outsider's perspective, but I'm very interested in it. I really didn't know anything about the church before I started this research. So I'm sure you all can teach me a lot too. But I talked to a lot of people, both in the Bay Area and in Salt Lake City, and both Latinos and whites within the church. And I had to spend a lot of time just getting up to speed on all aspects of your church. I got initially interested in this because a friend of mine happened to mention that he saw some Mormons proselyting in the Mission District of San Francisco, which if you live here, you know it's the Spanish-speaking area. And it really struck me as unusual because being an outsider, I just have always thought of the Mormon church as very homogeneous and white, and I was surprised to learn that the church was working on attracting other ethnic minorities. So, of course, I learned very soon that this was really not at all unusual, and that the Latino membership within the church is substantial. It's now about 30% of total membership throughout the world, and that it's growing at a much faster rate than Anglo membership. For instance, in the past 4 years, the U.S. membership of the church has grown by 8%, and the Latino membership has grown by 70%. In the last 4 years. This is according to the records that the church keeps. And church leaders say that it won't be long before Spanish is spoken by more members than English. So how is the church adapting to this changing membership, and how is the membership itself adapting to what has historically been a very, quote-unquote, American entity? This is what I was working on finding out. I also want to preface this by saying that even though my research takes a fairly critical view of the church, I basically believe that most white people in the United States, myself included, are to some extent racist, and it's very hard to be. It's very hard not to be when we grow up in this society, regardless of how hard we may try not to be, and regardless of our religion. I grew up in the Presbyterian Church, so I'm not trying to argue that the Mormon Church is somehow worse than other churches, or that Mormons are somehow more racist than other people, because I really don't believe that. This is also not your typical academic research paper. As a journalist, the way we do our research is largely by just talking to a lot of people. I did go into the church historical archives in Salt Lake City and looked at some of the oral histories there and talked to some of the people there. And I looked through some of Jesse Embry's oral histories at Brigham Young. So what are some of the concerns that I heard from Latinos within the church? One of the things that people said was that there was a lack of representative leadership within the upper levels of the church. Orlando Rivera is probably someone whom many of you know. He's teaches educational psychology at the University of Utah. He's a fourth-generation Mormon and also calls himself a Chicano, which for some Mormons is problematic because of its political connotations. But he said that one of the things that makes the church attractive to Latinos is the fact that people get to be leaders throughout the hierarchy. So that even at obviously since it's a lay church, people are leaders at the grassroots levels. And that in some countries in Latin America, he said the leadership is very arbitrary, so people feel they don't have control over their lives. And that the idea of being in a church where they can make a difference is attractive to them. On the other hand, he criticized the church for not having many Latinos in the 70 and none in the 12. There are currently 8 Latinos within the 70, and Rivera said that some of these are what you call Anglo of European background. There's one Argentine, a Colombian, a Chilean, 3 Mexicans, a Black Brazilian, and a Guatemalan. And Rivera also added that there are no U.S. minorities within that group. He said, like most American institutions, the church might have a fear of minorities for whatever reasons. They may like people who are more like themselves, more compliant. I think they might name a Chicano if he were very compliant, Rivera said, but they haven't even done that. I don't see diversity there. I talked to Don Lefevre of the church's public relations office about this, and he said that he agrees that the church leadership ought to reflect its membership and that the situation is improving, that they're working on that. He also cited the church's missionary and welfare work, and other people talked about this quite a bit too, that the church has 30,000 missionaries worldwide now. It spends tens of millions of dollars in welfare programs throughout the world, and as Bill Cottam told me, who's the director of church education in New York City, he said people care about where they spend their money. So it's obviously an indication of priorities. One of the other issues that was brought up often was the lack of cultural appreciation or lack of nurturing the culture of Latinos in the church. One woman by the name of Genevieve Soto Lee, who's a member in Southern California, said that she actually called me because she had heard that I was doing this research, and she said she is in the process of doing research on her family. Her family's been in the church about 3 generations, and she said, I've always heard about all these wonderful pioneer women, but never a Latina or a Hispanic woman. And so she sort of felt that she had to really dig to try to get some more information about her own background and the background of her family within the church. Another woman I talked with by the name of Abby Maestas lives in Salt Lake City. She's a professional there. She's 42. And she was a member of the church only until her early 20s, now considers herself an ex-Mormon. Her parents were migrant workers from Mexico and settled in this small town in Utah, eventually bought a house, and converted to Mormonism. And she credits the church with making some really profound changes in her family, and she's very complimentary of the church about that. She said that she basically believes the church saved her family from tragedy because there was a drinking problem, and when her parents converted, that went away. But she also is troubled by how the church acts towards non-white people, including herself. She said, the people who settled here, meaning in Utah, were white. The concept of brown being second class is ingrained in the church. That whole concept of we are superior, we are the elite group, has been passed from generation to generation, and that's racism at the utmost, she said. A man I talked with by the name of Richard Gomez also lives in Salt Lake City. He was a bishop of one of the Spanish-speaking branches in Salt Lake City, and he also served a term as a mission president in Mexico. And he said that the church is trying to improve its relations with minority members, and he really had a lot of good things to say about this. But he also said he feels left out as a Mexican-American when, for instance, church leaders will open a Mormon Pioneer Day celebration in Utah by asking who among the people assembled were descended from the original founders, Anglo founders. He said, that always kind of annoys me. There was a little Korean convert there too, and I know what he was thinking. He was thinking, I can't relate to that. He said, it's starting to change, but it's slow, because this is a very slow-changing and conservative church, and you have to accept that if you're going to be a part of it. So he is very active in the church, very much a leader in the church, and he sees some of these dynamics going on. This whole idea is related to the fear that the culture of the Mormon Church is necessarily American, and this is something I heard from Latinos quite a bit as well. Again, Richard Gomez said, the fear is that if you join the Mormon Church, you have to give up your cultural heritage. If you convert to the church, you have to give up too much of what you are. It's trying to do better in this regard, he said, but it doesn't have the infrastructure to maintain it as effectively as the white European culture that established the church. He adds that the church leadership is not representative enough, something that was mentioned earlier. The woman who considers herself an ex-Mormon, Abby Maesta, said her family was originally Catholic. She said, in Catholicism, there is room to celebrate the culture, and in Mormonism, there is none. She says, oh yeah, they may throw a taco in your direction now and then. But she said, there is diversity in that there are people of different colors, but as far as those people having some true power and true ownership in the church, she believes that that really doesn't happen very much. That the Latinos don't really help to make the culture of Mormonism, because the culture of Mormonism is American. One of the things that really interested me, and that I will admit that I brought up this issue far more often than people I talked to did, but I was very curious about it, and that was the mentions of the descriptions of the Lamanites in the Book of Mormon, and the idea that the Lamanites became dark-skinned because of their transgressions. This made me really wonder why how a Latino, somebody with Indian blood or Native American, could read some of these things and really feel accepted by the church. But people, I think every Latino I talked to about this said, it's really, you really have to read the whole thing, and it's really a badge of pride, because the Lamanites were the chosen people. But they also talked about the mixed messages involved. Abby Maesta said, I was taught as a child that if you are good, you will turn white. And that's a very confusing thing for people who are brown. It makes you feel like you're a second-class citizen. No one ever told the white kids if they were good, they'd turn dark. Orlando Rivera, the University of Utah professor, admitted, he said, there's some terrible language in there, but he said that overall it's more of a good thing than a bad thing. He did add, however, that the negative, that some of these descriptions of the Lamanites could be a problem, more so for the white members of the church who may read them and think that they justified some kind of discrimination against Native Americans or Latinos with Indian blood. I talked with a missionary here in Oakland. She was just finishing up her service in December, and she was from Mexico. She talked about how she had converted when she was about 13. She was the first person in her family in Mexico, and she was working up here in California. And she said that these descriptions of the Lamanites in the Book of Mormon at first kind of bothered her, and that she asked church leaders about this, and they said, no, this does not mean you're a second-class citizen. So she decided that if Jesus came to North America, that the Indians couldn't have been considered all bad, she said. And she said, you know, she looks at her arm and she goes, well, I'm still dark. You know, I haven't turned light yet, and that's okay with me. So this whole idea of how Latino Mormons view themselves is, I think, is really interesting, or how they find themselves viewed by whites. And there were several oral histories in Jesse Embry's collection at Brigham Young University. She talked to, I don't know how many people. She did a series of interviews in 1991. But she was specifically asking about things like race and how people felt being ethnic minorities within the church. One of the students, BYU students, she interviewed, or one of the interviewers talked to, was a Victor Aguila. He's Mexican. He said, one thing that bothers me about American Latter-day Saints is that they read the Book of Mormon and they think that the Lamanites of today still behave like the Lamanites of past times. They are very ignorant. They think that we are still warring with each other, running around naked, and eating people alive. So they think that all brown people are like that. The interviewer didn't really probe and ask him, well, what is it that makes you think that they think that way? It's just kind of ended there. Another student, this is also a 1991 interview, Burton Rojas, said, he's also Mexican, he said, most people in the United States, he lived in Tennessee, he said, most people never treated me any differently. Most people in the world don't think of me as Mexican or even as dark-skinned. Growing up, I never had any preferential or discriminatory things against me. I cannot recall one time. I had not experienced it until I came to BYU. That is something that caught me off guard because I lived down south and had people thinking I was black because I am very dark. I could understand that from where they were coming from in the history of the South. I don't agree with it, but I can understand it. I came to BYU and I found out here at BYU, more than any place I have ever been, there is a distinguishing factor. They distinguish. You are Mexican. You are black. You are this, and you are this. That was something that was new to me. My first semester here, I didn't really like it. Another woman in this series of interviews was not a student, and I don't have her age here. She sounds like she's probably in her 30s or 40s. She says she sees no discrimination in the church, but listen to her words. I think the biggest fault in the Hispanic people is the low self-esteem. They put themselves down. They are the ones that discriminate themselves. If you notice what I'm saying themselves. I'm excluding myself because I have never thought of myself as Hispanic. I never fill out a form when they ask about race because I think we are the human being race. Now, what is really interesting to me here is that this woman is talking about low self-esteem among Hispanics, but she herself seems to think little of her heritage to the point where she's completely divorced herself from any identification with it. And that may be unfair to assume on my part, and I wish I could talk to her myself, but this is what I hear in her words. One of the people I talked with, I interviewed, was Tony Yapias, who's 26 years old. He's a law student at BYU, and he's a devout Mormon. He's also founder of an organization called the Utah County Latino Council, which has been formed to offer free legal assistance and help in discrimination cases. This was just founded in January, so it's very new. And he says, when I asked him about discrimination in general or discrimination by the church, he says that the problems stem more from misunderstandings than bad intentions. He said, I've been discriminated against, but it's not purposely. People, more than anything else, they're ignorant. Yapias also blames Latinos, like this last woman, for bringing problems on themselves. He says, sometimes we give ourselves a bad image. A lot of the Hispanic organizations are too militant, too aggressive. But what they're doing in the process is they're segregating themselves. And he says that our policy, meaning the policy of his group, is to work in a positive way with the community. Again, I would argue that this is kind of an indication that Latinos have, to some extent, internalized the discrimination that they've encountered, perhaps both within and without the church, outside the church. I heard from a number of people that to talk about some of these issues, to talk about being unhappy in the church, is really not accepted. Many of you know about David Knowlton, who's the anthropologist who teaches at BYU. He was threatened with excommunication in November for saying publicly that his professional work was being stifled at BYU. And he says he's been castigated by the church elders since his days as an outspoken teenager when he was promoting evolution. But he said that now it seems to be getting a little bit different in that the church is keeping files on dissidents. This is what Knowlton says, and that the church has formed a strengthening church members committee which keeps track of those it sees as threats. He describes himself as Mormon to the core, but he says that his political views and his insistence on academic freedom make him unacceptable to his church. He's also, incidentally, I didn't mention this, but his specialty is Latin American issues. He says, "I'm welcome until I open my mouth. My journey is not accepted. It's like if you're an Orthodox Jew and you go get a bacon cheeseburger, you might as well just join Jews for Jesus and forget the whole thing." David Knowlton struck me as a very sincere person who deeply loves his church, and yet he's troubled by this, by the way some of his opinions have been received. You all know about George Lee, the Navajo, who was the first Native American member of the 70 who was excommunicated in 1989 for what the church called apostasy and other conduct unbecoming a member of the church. The church says even now that they won't comment on the case. I asked them. But Lee wrote in the letter to church authorities that he read at his excommunication hearing, "You are loving the Indians and other Lamanites at a distance and have no sense of responsibility to them." He also talked of the church's love of money, his words, saying, "You told me not to talk about the poor nor pray for them. Every weekend all we do is rub shoulders with the active or well-to-do while neglecting the poor who need our help the most." Orlando Rivera, the other professor, also talked about how members who criticize the church may risk some disciplinary action. He said he sort of alluded to this in his own experience. He said, "I ceased a long time ago to try to make suggestions. I found it wasn't appreciated." Another, in one of the series of oral histories that I looked at, well, I guess we're getting late, there was a guy who was a member of a Mormon congregation in San Antonio in the 50s. He and his wife were subject to some blatant discrimination, which was very common in the South in the 50s, we all know. Their bishop had requested that we not attend the Anglo ward anymore. He said that we belonged with the Mexicans. But what interested me was that he said, he was asked by the interviewer whether he'd ever brought this up with church leaders, and he said, "I wouldn't have been able to accomplish anything because then they would have really shut us out. It's very difficult for me to go say," and this, he was interviewed in the late 70s, "it's very difficult for me to go say, 'President Benson or President Kimball, I want an appointment because I've got something that has to be said. I wouldn't feel too comfortable about it because I'd hate to have the image come across that I'm criticizing them or putting them down or I feel like they're neglecting something because I don't.'" And just briefly, I'll wrap this up. I guess I talked with Don LaFever, the public relations person at the church, again about this, the idea that dissent is not tolerated within the church. And he says that the strengthening church members committee is to do just what its name implies, to strengthen the faith of church members who may be having a challenge or a problem. It's a totally positive thing, he said. But he also was very unequivocal about the church's position on matters of policy. He said, "To publicly criticize the church or the church leaders or its policies is grounds for disciplinary action." Those are his words. "Within our membership, there's a wide diversity of beliefs, political opinions. That, of course, is welcome and accepted. But as far as church doctrine goes, there is no compromise." I think I'll leave off there and just ask you if you have any questions or comments.
Mm-hmm. Two areas that came to mind that I wonder if your research touched on or if your interviews got into, and if so, what the discussion was. One is that President Spencer Kimball was known as making, as a large part of his mission being to minister to the Lamanites, and I wondered if you found any discussion of that and if any change, or how they evaluated his mission, whether they saw it as patronizing or a genuine effort and a change since he died.
Mm-hmm.
And then secondly, the practice of Spanish language wards in the United
yeah.
States, and how when I've attended those wards at different times, I found that people have told me, well, as soon as, you know, the people who come from Mexico or other Latin American countries and don't speak Spanish well, go. But as soon as the kids come up, they learn English, they go to the English-speaking ward. And I wondered if that would, if there was any discussion on that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I'll just repeat the question briefly. The first was, what was the response of Latinos to what Spencer Kimball had done with his ministry with the Lamanites, and has there been a change since he died? I think there was a sense that there was this special effort being made at the time. I didn't ask a lot of people about this, so I can't really say overall, but I did get the impression that there was a feeling that there was more being done then than is being done now. As far as the Spanish-speaking wards versus Anglo wards, and whether kids and children of immigrants start going to the Anglo wards, this was a really interesting issue, and there's still a lot of debate about it going on in the church, as you know, about whether it's a good idea to have the Spanish-speaking wards or any other, you know, ethnic wards. It seems to me, I guess, among the people I talk to, that there is this belief that the ideal would be for everyone to integrate and to give the Latinos the opportunity to have leadership within a more integrated group, not just within their sort of, you know, some people call it ghettoized groups. But on the other hand, there's the people who attend these wards say, it's really important for me to hear the gospel in my own language and to sing the hymns in my own language and to have the kind of cultural relationship with people in my ward that I want to have or that I know from being in Mexico. For instance, just the way people relate to each other physically, like do they hug and kiss a lot? Is that accepted? I think that some of the older Mormons I talked to who had been in the ethnic wards, they are, you know, their kids are now speaking English, and you know, perhaps they moved away from the area and they are starting to go to the Anglo wards. So that may be changing for, you know, as a generational thing, but obviously we still have many, many immigrants coming to the country all the time.
Mm-hmm. Well, one question, but I'll have time mm-hmm. for. Go ahead.
The question was about the Lamanite placement program at BYU and some of the scholarships, and the questioner said the program is now one quarter the size it was 8 years ago, something like that. No, this is. I visited BYU and talked to Lamond Tullis and David Knowlton and Jesse Embry there, and I heard about the Lamanite program, and I really, this is one of the things I'm interested in getting more into, but I really didn't learn much about it at the time, so I don't really have much to say in that respect. I'm sorry.
Could we hold the questions? Let's do our cheating at the end of the program. Between.
Yeah, I'll be around, too, if you want to ask me. Thank you.
Start again. One evening last July, can you hear me? Okay. One evening last July, to commemorate the 500th anniversary of the discovery of the New World, I went to hear Christopher Columbus speak. The place was underneath a large tent set up next to the stadium at Santa Clara University, a few miles down the road from here. The event was the first night of a four-evening Chautauqua tent show entitled Columbus and After, Rethinking the Legacy. The program, which toured California and Oregon last summer, was sponsored by the California and Oregon Councils for the Humanities. The goal was to provide a forum where the public can come to terms with an event that has profoundly shaped the world in which we live. During the following evenings, there would be opportunities to discuss, to dialogue with other historical figures, such as Father Junipero Serra, Chief Joseph, and westward expansionist Jesse Benton Fremont. But on that first evening, after we listened to Columbus describe his voyages to us, the program took an unexpected turn. When the Admiral was done, members of the audience were invited forward by the moderator to ask questions. Immediately, a delegation of Native Americans came to the microphone. They read a statement expressing displeasure at the celebration of Columbus's journey, and then started asking him some hard questions. Why did you abduct thousands of members of the Taino tribe to be taken into slavery in Spain? Why did you, as governor, order that every Indian on Hispaniola who did not supply to the Spanish every 3 months a hawk's bell filled with gold dust was to have his hands cut off? Though the Native Americans were dignified and calm in their questions, some members of the audience were becoming uneasy. This was obviously not part of the planned program for that evening. It was as though a ritual of celebration had somehow switched mid-ceremony into a session of cross-examination. After the Q&A concluded, Columbus took off his cap and robe, breaking character, and began talking to us in his real identity as W. Gregory Monahan, professor of history at Eastern Oregon State College in Le Grand. Surprisingly enough, Professor Monahan's own personal assessment of the Admiral was not much different from that of the critics, Indian and Anglo, who had been confronting him earlier. Columbus was a good sailor, he said, but he was a poor mariner and a terrible administrator. Now, we call him Christopher Columbus in English, but in Italian, Cristoforo Colombo, and in Spanish, Cristobal Colón. But there almost seem to be as many explanations of his character as there are versions of his name. What type of man was he? Was he the wise but misunderstood explorer that many of us remember from our history books, who heroically overcame tremendous odds to discover a new world? Or was he, as others would say, the cruel harbinger of all that was evil in European civilization, who repaid the hospitality of his innocent indigenous hosts with slavery, death, and disease? Mark Twain said that in a museum in Havana, there were two skulls of Christopher Columbus, one when he was a boy and one when he was a man. So which skull was the real Columbus? Was he a hero or was he a villain? The conflict which I witnessed over Columbus last summer in Santa Clara was a frequent matter for discussion last year, both in the media and in the schools. But the issues under dispute are significant not only because of their connection to the quincentennial. They have increased relevance this year, in 1993, which has been designated by the United Nations as the World Year of Indigenous Peoples. The controversy over the quincentennial involves much more than the simple question of whether Cristobal Colón was a good man. He's only one character in the story of this hemisphere. The larger issue is, how do we tell the story of America? The standard Latter-day Saint take on history sees Columbus as a heroic link in a divinely foretold chain of events, culminating in the restoration of the gospel and new world by the prophet Joseph Smith. This is based largely on one scripture, 1 Nephi chapter 13, verse 12, which we'll examine later. However, if we were to remove the specifically Mormon elements from the story, then the LDS interpretation is not that different from the secular one espoused by what Martin Marty would call America's civil religion. This is the traditional interpretation of U.S. history as it has been taught in our school for decades. For instance, Columbus's journey was the first step in a long process that eventually produced the United States of America, a daring experiment in democracy that in turn became a symbol and a haven of individual liberty for people throughout the world. Bill Bigelow, a high school teacher in Portland, puts it more ironically. Columbus is a figure in a kind of secular book of Genesis. In the beginning, there was Columbus. He was good, and so are we. However, Native Americans recount this creation drama in a much different way. The following is from a flyer put out by the Western Shoshone National Council announcing an anti-nuclear demonstration at the Nevada test site last October. Quote, when Columbus, looking for India, arrived in the Americas, a rich diversity of indigenous peoples lived in thousands of tribal nations and villages, spoke thousands of languages and dialects, had a highly developed culture and spirituality, and lived in delicate balance with the earth. The arrival of Columbus marked the beginning of 500 years of invasion, colonization, genocide, ecological destruction, and injustice, which continues today. But even before the quincentennial, this sentiment was expressed, for instance, in Ecuador by Maria Toque, a Quiché Indian from Guatemala, attending the First Continental Congress of Indigenous Peoples in July 1990. She said, we, the indigenous peoples, will not celebrate. How could we celebrate the moment which began with the stealing of our lands, the massacres, kidnappings, and tortures of our people? Since then, we've had thousands of widows and orphans. How are we to celebrate 500 years as we continue to be starved to death? From the Native American point of view, the Columbus Day holiday on October 12th was just as offensive as a holiday on October 27th would be to Latter-day Saints, which commemorated the anniversary of Lilburn Boggs' extermination order. Nevertheless, last year, some non-LDS writers objected to this interpretation. Arthur Schlesinger in The Atlantic labeled it revisionism, pointing out that this only redresses the balance up to a point, but driven by Western guilt, revisionism may verge on masochism. He argued that history's one constant is change, and that the cost of change in terms of human suffering and destruction must be compared with the benefits which the discovery has brought. A more strident tone was taken by a writer in the Los Angeles Times, who decried anti-Columbus sentiment as irrational, racist political correctness. He wrote, some cultures are better than others. Productivity is better than stagnation. In fact, Western civilization stands for men and women at their best. We should honor Western civilization, not for the ethnocentric reason that some of us happen to have European ancestors, but because it is the objectively superior culture. I'm reminded of Gandhi's response when asked, what do you think of Western civilization? He replied, it would be a good idea. The traditional interpretation of American history refers to the discovery of America. And the alternative interpretation refers to the invasion, or the encounter, or to the incursion. But perhaps we can compare these two incommensurate interpretations with historical pageants. The traditional patriotic interpretation and the alternative revisionist interpretation are both based on historical fact. But just as in any theatrical pageant or television docudrama, certain characters and scenes are selected for special emphasis, while other events are glossed over, telescoped, or left on the cutting room floor. An actual pageant may succeed in being authentic, but can never be totally impartial. However, from a religious standpoint, it is germane to note that LDS scriptures can be used to support both interpretations. Let's go to 1 Nephi chapter 13, verse 12. The writer is Nephi, describing a lengthy vision of the future given to him by the power of the Holy Ghost. And I looked and beheld a man among the Gentiles who was separated from the seed of my brethren by the many waters. And I beheld the Spirit of God, that it came down and wrought upon the man. And he went forth upon the many waters, even unto the seed of my brethren who were in the promised land. This description seems to match Columbus. He himself relates how the Almighty inspired him to embark on his enterprise. But there seem to be some anomalies. If he was indeed inspired by the Spirit, how do we explain the acts of brutality and cruelty which are documented by reputable sources, such as Bartolome de las Casas, which are even included in biographies by people such as Samuel Eliot Morison? Let's look at the issue of slavery for a moment. I quote from Hans Koning's book, Columbus, His Enterprise, Exploding the Myth. Slavery began on the first voyage, but on the second voyage, the cruelty reached new heights. I quote, we are now on February 1495. Time was short for getting back a good dividend on the supply ships getting ready for the return to Spain. Columbus therefore turned to a massive slave raid as a means for filling up these ships. The brothers rounded up 1,500 Arawaks, men, women, and children, and imprisoned them in pens, guarded by men and dogs. The ships had room for no more than 500, and thus only the best specimens were loaded aboard. The admiral then told the Spaniards they could help themselves and the remainder to as many slaves as they wanted. Those whom no one chose were simply kicked out of their pens. Such had been the terror of these prisoners that, in the description of one of the colonists, they rushed in all directions like lunatics, women dropping and abandoning infants in the rush, running for miles without stopping, fleeing across mountains and rivers. Of the 500 slaves, 300 remained alive in Spain, arrived alive in Spain, where they were put up for sale in Seville, as naked as the day they were born. The slave trade immediately turned out to be unprofitable, for the slaves mostly died. Columbus decided to concentrate on gold instead. Though he writes, "Let us, in the name of the Holy Trinity, go on sending all the slaves that can be sold." Perhaps one way to explain these discrepancies and anomalies in Columbus's life is to look at Doctrine and Covenants 121. A man can be inspired of God, feel the Spirit, do a certain task at a certain time of his life. But if he exercises unrighteous dominion, the Spirit will leave him. Let me quote from Kirkpatrick Sale on Columbus's fourth voyage. The fourth voyage is For all his navigational skill and all his fortuitous headings, Admiral Colon could be a quite wretched mariner. The four voyages is properly seen, quite apart from bravery and fortitude, are replete with lubberly mistakes, misconceived sailing plans, foolish disregard of alimentary maintenance, and stubborn neglect of basic safety, all characterized by what can best be called a kind of eco-hubris, the assertion of human superiority over the natural realm. Almost every time Colon went wrong, it was because he'd refused to bend to the inevitabilities of tide and wind and reef, or more arrogantly still, had not bothered to learn about them. The very same reckless courage that led him across the ocean in the first place and saw him through storm and tumult to return lay behind his numerous misfortunes. And then he goes on to comment on how everything went wrong during the fourth voyage. And I'm reminded of D&C 121, those who exercise unrighteous dominion are left to kick against the pricks, persecute the saints, and fight against God. Perhaps this is why Hans Koenig calls Columbus a man greedy in small and large things. Now, whether or not Columbus's devotion to God and receipt of inspiration are outweighed by all these acts of cruelty and unrighteousness, it's a matter for heaven to decide. If he has sufficiently repented in the afterlife, and the vicarious baptism performed for him in 1898 by Wilfred Woodruff in the St. George Temple will be efficacious. If he is not, then I suppose he will learn the meaning of Jesus' statement in Matthew 7, and he will say to me in that day, "Lord, Lord, have we not prophesied in thy name, and in thy name done many wonderful works? Then will I profess unto them, I never knew you. Depart from me, ye that work iniquity." Mormon. There are countless other references to the Gentiles. And Nephi's vision includes not only a description of the Gentiles settling in the promised land and being delivered from their mother country, but also of events still in the future which have not yet occurred. Let me go on to that. There's two reasons why we need to pay attention to the traumas and pains of our past here in America. One is that there are scriptures which are not yet fulfilled. The other is that the suffering is still going on. First, let's go to 3 Nephi chapter 16. We'll talk about that briefly. There are certain phrases which recur in 3 Nephi 16, chapters 20 and 21 also. And I recommend an examined reading of this. For instance, chapter 16, verse 8. But woe saith the Father unto the unbelieving of the Gentiles, for notwithstanding they have come forth upon the face of this land and have scattered my people who are of the house of Israel. My people who are of the house of Israel have been cast out from among them and have been trodden under feet by them. Notice the phrases, cast out, trodden under feet. Going to verse 10. At that day when the Gentiles shall sin against my gospel, and shall reject the fullness of my gospel, and shall be lifted up from the pride of their heart above all nations, and above all the people of the whole earth, and shall be filled with all manner of lyings, and of deceits, and of mischiefs, and all manner of hypocrisy, and murders, and priestcrafts, and whoredoms, and secret abominations, if they shall do all these things, and shall reject the fullness of my gospel, behold, saith the Father, I'll bring the fullness of my gospel from among them. Going down to verse 13. If the Gentiles will repent and return unto me, saith the Father, behold, they shall be numbered among my people, O house of Israel. Verse 14, and I will not suffer my people, who are of the house of Israel, to go through among them and tread them down. The roles are reversed. If the Gentiles do not repent, they will be receiving the same thing which they used to dish out. Verse 15, if they will not turn unto me and hearken unto my voice, I will suffer them. Yea, I will suffer my people, O house of Israel, that they shall go through among them, the Gentiles, and shall tread them down, and they shall be a salt that has lost its savor. The Nephites and Lamanites didn't understand this doctrine. Jesus concluded his sermon, but continued discussing this the next day and made it even more clear. 3 Nephi chapter 20. Verses 15 and 16. And I say unto you that if the Gentiles do not repent after the blessing which they shall receive, the blessing of the gospel, the blessings of prosperity and God's fortune on them, after they have scattered my people, then shall ye, who are a remnant of the house of Jacob, go forth among them. And ye shall be in the midst of them who shall be many. And ye shall be among them as a lion among the beasts of the forest, and as a young lion among the flocks of sheep, who if he goeth through, both treadeth down and teareth in pieces, and none can deliver. As a lion among the beasts of the forest, as a young lion among the flocks of sheep. Perhaps the beasts of the forest could refer to those in dominion over the Gentiles who are continuing to engage in oppression. Perhaps the sheep could refer to the masses of the Gentiles who are standing by while this is happening. Verse 20. And it shall come to pass, saith the Father, that the sword of my justice shall hang over them that day, at that day. Except they repent, it shall fall upon them, saith the Father, even upon all the nations of the Gentiles. And these things are repeated again in chapter 21. Now, the second crucial reason why we need to overcome these patterns of denial is because the anguish endured by the Indians is not merely a historical phenomenon. It's continuing today. There's a tendency by Latter-day Saints to assume that the scattering of the seed of Lehi by the Gentiles all occurred in the past, and that the fulfillment of those prophecies is already fulfilled, is already completed. And this is inaccurate. Unnoticed by most citizens of the first world, the treading down of native peoples is still continuing. For instance, recent issues of the publication Cultural Survival describe struggles being waged now by the Yanomami and Wasig in Brazil, the Ixil Maya in Guatemala, the Tawaka Sumu in eastern Nicaragua and Honduras, the Puencas in Chile, the Oodham in the Sonoran Desert of Mexico, the Paipai of Yamao in Baja California. Each tribe is attempting to retain or preserve its homeland from those who would colonize or despoil it. The non-Lamanite tribal peoples are also being threatened. In my mother's country, the Philippines, tribes such as the Kalinga, the Manobo, the Taboli, the Subanon are fighting against the forces of reforestation and development. In Malaysia, the Penan of Sarawak have seen one-third of their forests felled over the past 30 years. In New Guinea, more than 150,000 West Papuans fighting to preserve their own ancestral rainforests have already been killed by the Indonesian military. One writer says, the destruction of the West Papuans has few parallels. The invasion of the Americas and Australia are being reborn today in West Papua. And I seriously doubt whether the Penan or the Papuans would consider that the Indonesian, Malaysian nation-states, which encompass them roundabout, fit the Jeffersonian dictum of governments that derive their just consent, just powers from the consent of the governed. If the tragedies which attended the Gentiles' colonization of America, injustice, invasion, ecocide, and genocide, are indeed being duplicated all over the globe today, then we need to seriously reevaluate the legacy of both Columbus and the Gentiles. Now, all my previous comments are based on the proposition that the Book of Mormon is historically and spiritually true. If it is not, perhaps we don't need to pay attention to these warnings. Recent events have made this more relevant to me. A few years ago, I was at a conference like this one at the University of California, Santa Barbara, sponsored by the Center for a Postmodern World, looking at the challenges of how to meet the crisis of the environment. Jim Wallace, editor of Sojourners, progressive evangelical magazine in Washington, D.C., had just finished describing what life was like in inner city in Washington. And as I listened to him, I was reminded of what Moroni said in Mormon Chapter 8. Let me just quote briefly. He told how drug trafficking has become a livelihood for poor youth or denied access to the alluring attractions of American consumer culture. But the values of the youth were not unusual in our culture, because what message does our society give young people every day about what is most important in life? Have they not been convinced, like most other Americans, that status and success come by way of material acquisition? Does the way people get rich even matter now in America? And when he spoke of the poor living in some of the poor living in D.C. who feel that they don't even exist because of the indifference of others to their plight, I was reminded of the words of Moroni. Why do you adorn yourselves with that which hath no life, and yet suffer the hungry, the needy, the naked, and the sick, and the afflicted to pass by you and notice them not? During the question and answer period after Jim Wallace's comments, a Native American student approached the microphone. I recognized him from a previous session where he had been indignant over the upcoming celebration of the quincentennial in a few years. But as he addressed the audience that night, he seemed different. He spoke with an unusual dignity and energy. It was as though he was not speaking for himself alone, but as an official voice filled with authority on behalf of all his people. We are the landlords in this hemisphere, he said. You were our guests. You still are guests. Take your tax funds, he told us, and organize life support systems that will care for those who are in need, the ones who are homeless, the ones who are poor, the ones who are suffering. If you fail to do this, you are not worth living on this planet, and you will be removed. I swear to you, if it is the last thing that I do, you will be removed. Every parasite will be removed from the surface of the planet. As sure as there's a sun shining in the sky, I tell you that this is true. You have not yet discovered America. You have not yet found out where you really are. You have not yet learned of the powers that have been around you all the time, guarding you and protecting you. And I assure you, as we are guardians of the earth, we can also purify it. He paused for a moment. No more did he seem like a dignified chief delivering an ultimatum. He looked a bit embarrassed, as though he'd said too much. Thank you very much, he said. I tell you this in love, because I care for you, because I love you. And we went back to his seat. The audience gave him a loud ovation. So since then, whenever I read 3 Nephi and contemplate the blessings and curses promised to the inhabitants of this land of promise, I remember those words of warning and reproof delivered to the audience in Santa Barbara that Sunday night 4 years ago. And whether the events I witnessed were in some small way part of the beginning of fulfillment of prophecy, I don't know. But I do know that I can't take them lightly. A few weeks after I wrote this paper last year, the American Indian Movement held a tribunal in San Francisco, putting the United States on trial for what has happened to the American Indians during the past 500 years. And as I sat there listening to their testimony from Native Americans, Hawaiians, Puerto Ricans, Mexican Americans, blacks, I was wondering whether a legal framework was being set up to justify what could happen in the future. So as we look back on the quincentennial last year and contemplate this year's 500th anniversary of Columbus's second voyage, where the slavery began to escalate, we should not denigrate the demonstrators who interrupted our celebrations last year with cries of 500 years of oppression. They had good reason to complain. But as Christians under covenant, to mourn with those that mourn may be entirely appropriate for us to join with those who nonviolently protest. and to publicly grieve for all the innocent lives that were lost in the New World during the past half millennium. Men, women, and children, Indians, Europeans, and Africans, Lamanites and Gentiles, immigrants, and indigenous. And in addition to mourning, perhaps we should ponder what could be done to preserve the remnant of Lehi's descendants who are still in danger. 1 Nephi 13, Nephi was also told in the vision that although the Gentiles would be lifted up by the power of God above all other nations, the Lord God would not suffer that the Gentiles will utterly destroy the mixture of thy seed, or destroy the seed of thy brethren. The fulfillment of the Lord's promise to Nephi may yet depend on us. If those among the Gentiles who are numbered among the covenant people of the Lord, having accepted the gospel, were to stand up in defense of those who are being slain, especially the indigenous peoples of the earth, many souls could be blessed. Unknown remnants of the seed of Nephi and the house of Israel could perhaps be preserved. More importantly for us, the Gentile nations would be leavened by our deeds and made less ripe for destruction. Now, the same issue of the Atlantic, where Arthur Schlesinger spoke about Columbus, contains a surprising account of successful nonviolent protests in Nazi Germany. Those long-forgotten actions, only recently documented, compelled the Nazi leaders to back down, forcing changes in policy, including, in one special case, the release of Jews slated for the death camps. So the influence of a righteous, nonviolent minority should not be underestimated. In the words of Barry Lopez, naturalist, in his book, The Rediscovery of North America, "Looking back on the invasion of America, we can take the measure of the horror and assert that we will not be bound by it. We can say, yes, that this happened, and we are ashamed. We repudiate the greed. We recognize and condemn the evil. We see how the harm has been perpetuated. But 500 years later, we intend to mean something else in the world." And following the example of the people of anti-Nephi Lehi, we could repudiate the violence of our Gentile predecessors. And just as the Jewish survivors remembering the Nazi Holocaust say never again, we can also look back on our legacy of five centuries and firmly say, never again. Never again shall the Gentiles scatter another nation. Never again shall the Gentiles trod down another native people or tribe. So the pageant of America isn't over yet. The exits to the amphitheater are locked and blocked, and the last act of the play will consist of mandatory audience participation. Whether the show will have a joyous, happy ending depends entirely upon the new cast. In other words, upon all of us. Thank you.